towards Imam al-Hussein. Too ashamed to look at his face. Ya ibn Rasulillah. Is there any room for repentance? Can I ask you for forgiveness? Let's all say this. Ya Baqiyatullah. I know I have done wrong towards you. I know you remember me daily, and I don't remember you weekly or monthly. Even. Ya Hujjatullah, I don't have what it takes to come to you and ask you for forgiveness. But ya Baqiyatullah, where else can I go? I don't have any other place to go. Imam al-Hussein looks at Hur. He says, don't worry, anta hurrun kama sammatka ummuk. You're a free man as your mother called you. Stand up, be proud. What happens? A man who was with Yazid, a man who was with Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad, a man who was with Shimr, with Umar ibn Sa'd, comes and joins Imam al-Hussein. His last breath, Imam al-Hussein, is over his body. Imagine what Hur is going to. Who am I, the son of Zahra, to come to my body? I don't deserve this. Inshallah, Imam al-Hujjah will forgive us. Inshallah, he will accept us. Ala la'natullah ala al-qawm al-zalimeen. وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون يا حسين
ذامن الظهران Times of sadness have come The crescent has now arrived Casting gloom on Karbala Casting gloom on Karbala
On the ninth it heard the prayers of those pure souls Fought the rising sun for Perhaps this could be its role Akbar's azan so clear This moon filled with fear How will it possibly arise and see the state of those dear and see the state of those dear
the moon of Muharram times of sadness have come the crescent has now arrived casting gloom on Karbala Casting gloom on Karbala Casting gloom on Karbala
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran
Hosseiniya. To his path from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bihi nasta'in.
Dr. Fakh Rohani.
In the beginning, I should like to express my sincere condolences on the coming of the month Muharram, the grief-stricken month. For not only Shiites but all Muslims. We've come to the stage and to the scene where Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya, one of the stepbrothers of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, suggested him not to leave Medina because everybody knew well that the safety for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, that safety for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was of utmost importance. As soon as Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was determined to leave Medina in defiance to the suggestion to recognize Yazid, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam wrote a very important letter to his stepbrother Muhammad ibn al-Hanafi. In fact, it's a very important document in the life and times of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. In the letter Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam wrote to Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya, and this is a very important document in this regard. He indicated it in this way. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. This is what al-Husayn ibn Ali has commanded to his brother Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya, that al-Husayn bears witness that there is no God except Allah, who is unique with no partner for him, and that Muhammad is his servant and messenger, rightly came from his side, and that paradise is a fact and hell is a fact, and that the hour, that is the day of resurrection, will come. There's no doubt thereof. And because Allah shall give shall raise those who are in the graves. It refers to the resurrection. And indeed, I haven't revolted boisterously, insolently, corruptingly, or oppressively. Rather, I've risen up seeking to rectify the affairs of the Ummah of my grandfather, that is all the Muslim community. Indeed, to call for the good, I intend to call for the good and to prohibit committing the undesirable, and to act in accordance with the conduct of my grandfather and father Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Hence, anybody who accepts this from me, they've already accepted the cause of Allah. And if nobody answers me in this regard, I shall remain steadfast until Allah judges between me and the people, that is the Umayyads. For he is the best of all judges. And this is my last will and testament to you, my brother. And my success is from Allah alone. In him I have placed my trust, and to him I turn repentant. Well, the last phrase is in fact a Quranic verse. With these remarks made by Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam in the beginning stage of his movement, now we find that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam intended to come up to accomplish a great correction or rectification in the affair of Muslims. That is, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, as the infallible imam, found out that a wrong line had started right after the demise of the Prophet Muhammad, and it was his duty not to remain indifferent to the affair of Muslims. So we find that the aim of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was to teach Muslims the purely Islamic teachings and those important things that his grandfather, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, had introduced to people as the fundamental tenets of the Islamic religion. From this perspective, we understand that the mission of an infallible imam is in fact the continuation of the mission of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Or, to put it differently, had the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam been alive at that time, he would certainly take the same decision as that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam took.
Junk Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Dispossession, the great social housing swindle directed by Paul Sung. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him is Claudia Webb, who is a Labour Party councillor in the London Borough of Islington. Now, Dispossession is a documentary that explores the catastrophic failures by successive governments that have led to a chronic shortage of social housing in Britain. The film focuses on the neglect, demolition, and regeneration of council estates across the UK and investigates how the state works with the private sector to demolish council estates to build the land they stand on, making properties that are unaffordable to the majority of people.
They're going to regenerate it, which means total demolition. And when it very first started, it was a case of nothing will happen without your approval. Well, that was lie number one on day one, and it's never changed.
We've got councils of all kinds across London who are trying to demolish traditional council estates. They're actually destroying communities.
It was Mrs. Thatcher whose right to buy scheme was a vote winner for families like the Pattersons. She gave them the title deeds to their council house. They gave her tea in return.
Don't you think this is lovely?
The right to buy was probably the most popular policy ever introduced by Conservative government.
Housing is a fundamental human need, and it's one that the market just doesn't seem to be capable of providing.
We should be building every year about 240,000 to 250,000 homes, and we're nowhere near that.
I want there to be no-hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
Essentially, we've had successive governments that simply haven't seen the role for social housing, and they've been cutting it.
It's not seen as being aspirational, and aspiration is the key word.
Last 10, 20 years, housing stock that used to be here is down, it's gone.
Access to housing, landlord, to social housing is nigh on impossible.
They are tearing apart our community, brick by brick, and we're not going to let them.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a very serious problem facing this country, and it was a very moving and deeply personal documentary for the director, I believe, as he grew up on a council estate. And especially in the wake of the Grenfell Tower tragedy, this film comes at a very important time. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I was very impressed by it. I thought the first time I saw this film, I was a little bit concerned about how compacted it was, the amount of information it crams into an hour and I think 26 minutes. The second time I saw it, I was impressed by the amount of information that it did get in, the amount of ground that it covers, the fact that it covers all these issues from so many different angles. I mean, you're getting the input of the politicians who have to make the policy decisions that cause estates to be built or to be knocked down. You're also getting the input from people on the ground, residents of the estates, who have a very different take on it. So I'm a big fan of this film.
So as you say, this documentary, it was very dense, packed with information, statistics, and usually these films are quite difficult to watch. So do you think the director was successful in conveying his message then?
Yes, because in part I think that it makes its points pictorially. I mean, it is very crisply shot, and it's one of the situations where I think if we're walking down a street anywhere, this is the kind of issue that hits you smack in the face. You know, we could go for a walk around the studios here and we would see 3, 4, 5 luxury flat developments, springing up everywhere. But we'd probably see more homeless people than we'd see social housing developments going up. And the film is very acutely attuned to what is actually happening at street level. And it shows you the disrepair that many estates have fallen into, and it contrasts that with the slightly sort of eerie gloom of these new developments going up that don't seem to be inhabited by anyone because no one's got the money to afford to move in there.
And Claudia, if I could turn to you now, as someone who works closely with this issue, is the social housing crisis in this country as bad as the documentary suggests it is?
Well, the documentary highlights quite well, actually, the state of play of council housing and council house in the UK, and in particular, actually, in London, and the sort of the dilemma that councils face as against the sort of the notion of community, the notion of identity, and the notion of neighbourhood. The concept of fairness, right at the very heart of an urban inner city area, and what does a home mean, and it begins to explore what that means today as against what it should have meant. And what we've got really in terms of what the documentary portraying and what the film's portraying is this whole issue of, you know, council homes being sold off for profit, council land being sold off for profit, and exposing really a reality and dichotomy of huge waiting lists, homelessness, and yet council homes being sold in off of profit against that sort of waiting list, and then what happens to communities and what happens to neighbourhoods. It's a stark contrast, and the film's really brought home and brought out the realities of the dangers of making the wrong decisions.
Indeed, and this documentary, one of the key messages is that a home is a right and not a privilege.
We need to offer housing to people at lower rates than full market cost. And the way historically we've done that is we've built social housing, we've provided housing to people that the state has some direct investment in, on the premise that not everybody can afford to rent at full market cost, or indeed afford to purchase their own home.
The current government has slashed investment in social housing so much that the housing crisis can only get worse. The only solution is to invest in social housing again, both through local authorities to build council homes and through housing associations to build social homes, in the way that the post-war government invested. And they need to be homes that people can afford, not homes that are called affordable, which are not.
If you build a council estate and people move in, those people pay rent to the local authority. After a few years, then the cost of building has paid for itself. Whereas if you have private rent, A, it's a lot more expensive, B, that money goes straight into landlords' pockets and doesn't get reinvested. It's a really good economic model, and it also points to the fact that housing should be a right for everybody.
In this documentary, we learn there's various misconceptions about social housing. Claudia, if I could ask you, why is there a need for social housing?
Well, social housing is really relevant in a local area where people, in a sense, can't afford to live in a home unless housing is provided that meets their ability to pay for that home. And in a sense, what we've got is a growing population and basic need. And a basic need is a roof over your head. And if councils are deprived from building homes, then in a sense what you've got is demand outstripping supply. And really what the documentary highlighted by showing clips of Margaret Thatcher, it highlights Thatcherism and the policies of Thatcherism, which at the time
was the right to buy scheme.
Which was one, the issue about right to buy, but two, under Thatcherism, they stopped councils from building council homes. Councils used to be a machine for council homes. So within local authorities, you not only saw the production of homes, but you also saw the architects, the builders, the quantity surveyors, all of the professional skill sets located within the council. Those skill sets have long gone.
And thank you for that point and shedding light on the need for social housing. And Mike, if I can turn to you now, we learned from the film that there are various stigmatisms about social housing. What are they? What are some of these stigmatisms?
Well, one of the issues that the film addresses very well is the recent rise of TV shows like benefits street and things like that, where people who live on housing estates are, you know, it's these places are called sink estates, and you know, there's a certain stigma that goes with that. But there's a portrayal of people who live on estates as feckless and, you know, alcoholic, and you know, someone who's
scrounging.
Exactly, that's the kind of show. And these shows are very cheap to produce, like all reality TV, very cheap to produce, can get syndicated and make a TV channel or production company lots of money. What they actually give back to a society, a country, a community, very little. It's you know, to stigmatize the people who appear on these shows and people who live on council estates in general. And I think part of that is that because these shows are made by people from outside those communities looking in. And it's often, as the film suggests, people who actually live on council estates, they have a community, they have a life there, they know where they're going, they know, you know, where their house relates to other people, the people who live next door to them. And it's not a sink estate. It's they're not circling the plug hole. You know, they're getting by. These places are functional, but they're being depicted in such a way as to suggest that they're not, and that they need knocking down.
We're going to continue this discussion in the next part.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
In his first public speech following Labour's landslide victory in 1997's general election, Tony Blair stood on the Aylesbury estate in south-east London and vowed there would be no forgotten people in the Britain his party wanted to build. 20 years later, residents of the Aylesbury might wonder what happened to New Labour's bold vision of the future. Since 2001, campaigners have fought against Southwark Council's plans to regenerate the estate. The council argue that the Aylesbury needs to be demolished due to the high cost of essential repairs. Campaigners claim that the council allowed the estate to deteriorate in order to facilitate its demise and justify a £1.5 billion redevelopment project.
So we saw Tony Blair there. And Claudia, I have to ask you, why didn't Blair fulfil his promises?
Well, I mean, I think the reality is that when in 1997 Labour came into power in the aftermath of Thatcherism, in the aftermath of councils not being invested in to build council housing, and you know, one could have wished and hoped that the new policy of Labour would have been to enable councils to build council homes again. A good council will build good quality homes, and with the resources and the investment, we'll invest in the stock that it has. But equally, if designs aren't right, and you know, designs for their time aren't always fit for the future, and you then need to think about how do you make that housing stock work? How do you make it livable and continue to be enjoyable? But equally, what's important is, and what I fundamentally believe in, is if you are going to regenerate an estate, then what you need to bring back is council housing. You regenerate the estate to create continued council homes, and that we shouldn't need to, as councils, go into business with the private sector and sell off the land and sell off the homes for profit. And that's what councils need investment, so they don't have to do that. Maybe that they weren't presented with was the investment that was necessary to rebuild council homes rather than engaging in a partnership with the private sector.
So you're saying that the Labour Party, the New Labour back then, effectively inherited this crisis. But Mike, from the documentary I get the sense that the Conservative Party are much to blame, but do Labour share as much blame also?
Well, one of the strengths of the film is that it recognises that this is essentially a non-partisan issue. You know, everyone, whether you're of the right or of the left, needs a roof above your head. And I think it recognises, as much as, you know, Labour and the Conservatives like to play this fun game on Question Time of blaming one another for previous policies, there is a degree to which both parties are to blame, and this is why we're in the situation that we're in now. But yes, that right to buy scheme was, although a huge success at the time, has proven to have taken so many properties out of the public sphere and put them in private hands. But I think at the same time, the film says that, you know, when Tony Blair did come into power, not enough was done to counteract that policy. It was seen as such a sort of overwhelming success. What can you do? You know, well, you could build more houses, and I think that was one of the issues that leads to the situation that we're in right now, that we simply don't have enough houses for the people who need them.
And another, I want to talk about a different aspect of the documentary now. And one of the effects of the housing crisis seems to be the dismantling of the sense of community. I get this sense from the documentary that the film suggests that there were outside parties that were directly targeting and sort of dividing the community in order to conquer it. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is, in some ways, what the film is talking about is the direction of the entire nation over the past 50 years. I mean, we're told very early on that a lot of social housing was built close to factories, close to industries. And of course, once those industries closed down in the 60s, 70s, 80s, the last decade or so, where do the people who live on those estates go now? You know, how do they pay their rents? And if they can't pay their rents, does someone come in and take their property away from them? And so that it's raising bigger questions than just questions around housing. It's about, you know, who, you know, how much responsibility do councils have for the people who live in within their remit?
Well, we'll just have to pause there again just for now. I'll let you get back to that point, Claudia.
As the estate falls into decay, I believe it was a deliberate strategy of the local authority, because they saw the Elephant Castle at the time as a prime market for real estate.
I haven't got all the details on the Haygate, but my understanding is that some of the social rental properties will be built in another part of the borough. But again, it's around the fact that if we are going to take down a certain number of social rented properties, it's about making sure we're re-providing that, actually re-providing more for the same level of rent.
For the demolition of 9,000 plus council homes and their replacement with luxury apartments costing £600,000 and £700,000 as an entry price, was their answer to the problem? That's no answer to the 9,000, 10,000 tenants that were living in secure accommodation at the time that are now dispersed across London, and many dispersed outside of London.
People who benefit from the housing crisis are, of course, property developers. They want to have the densest housing possible. And the best way to make dense housing is to build luxury apartments and to make it look like, you know, you're building a tall tower block, not to house many families as they did in the 60s and 70s, but to give a really slick community lifestyle.
Now, before we went to that clip, we were just talking about the notion of dismantling of the community by the outside parties. Claudia, did you agree with what Mike said?
Well, I mean, I have a different take on it, because obviously we're in, my context is London, and I can see that in areas like Newark, in Nuneaton, for example, which had a coal industry, that they can create homes around a particular industry, and then that industry disappears in terms of the mining industry, then you are left with homes and people without access to meaningful work. That's not the case in London. What you've got in London is a total land grab. It's a disgrace, really, in terms of a total land grab by big developers who are basically capitalising on the opportunity that is presented by the lack of inability of councils to build and invest in homes. The policy of not allowing councils to build homes, that is what's been problematic, because it's been over decades and not over a few years. What we have now in places like my own borough, where we have a good council that is building good quality homes, we bucked the trend and we sought to build council homes, and we sought to find ways to do that and ensure that we do not sell off council land. But where we have planning, where we give planning permissions to the developers where they've got their own private land, what unfortunately has been created historically over time is the notion of poor. We have a policy of 50% of that must be affordable. Affordable meaning, you know, social rent properties. And what they do is they build that integral to the development, but they build it on the side or at the back, and and that's where the creation of poor doors happens.
Of course,
it's
you're in Jeremy Corbyn's borough, and he pledged to end the housing crisis. But I want to talk about this notion now in the film of social cleansing, which seems to be a contentious, controversial term, which means that low-income workers are being driven out of the capital, London, because of the soaring rents and the interests of corporations, of course, and real estate agents. What do we learn in the film about this?
The film's very good on gentrification and how neighbourhoods have changed in rapidly over the last 10, 15, 20 years. So, you know, social housing is of less concern than attracting middle-class renters with lots of disposable income who can afford coffee and hummus and all the treats of living in the inner cities. But, you know, there is a degree to which housing policy seems to have been skewed specifically, almost exclusively towards that particular demographic. And, of course, that, you know, drives out people who are originally living there, and you know, that's one of the many big issues that this film addressed.
Well, part of that was, you know, the whole huge banking crisis that happened. You know, what happened after the banking crisis was in London. Then, London's property market was then used as the place where people invest. And so, what you've got is overseas investors purchasing land and property, never ever living in those properties and creating a this and them scenarios and situations. What is a disgrace is when it's set against that. So you've already got that as a problem going on. Set against that is when councils have got land and homes in council control. What is a disgrace is councils then selling that off in some kind of partnership with the private sector.
It is such a complex issue.
It is.
And unfortunately, we're running out of time in this programme. And just final 30 seconds to Mike. Would you recommend this documentary?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're now in a situation where the Evening Standard can run a front page about house prices going up as though that's some great triumph. To me, it looks more and more like a tragedy. And this film absolutely reflects that.
Well, thank you very much for your time and joining the show. And I'm afraid that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you.
In the limelight. A group of parents in Florida are suing the state's governor, Ron DeSantis, for preventing schools from introducing mask mandates when children return to the classroom in September. The lawsuit comes amid a surge of coronavirus cases in the state and across America, with the number of new infections hitting 100,000 a day, the highest level in 6 months. The article you're about to hear has been written by Jamie Johnson, a journalist working for The Telegraph. The piece is titled, Florida Parents Sue Governor Ron DeSantis Saying Children Could Die Because of Mask Mandate Ban. A group of parents in Florida are suing the state's governor, Ron DeSantis, for preventing schools from introducing mask mandates when children return to the classroom in September. The lawsuit comes amid a surge in coronavirus cases in the state and across America, with the number of new infections hitting 100,000 a day, the highest level in 6 months. The parents argue that students will become sick and potentially die as a result of the failure to follow the mandatory masking requirements set forth by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. Earlier this summer, the CDC said that only unvaccinated children need masks at school. In the face of the Delta variant of the coronavirus, however, the CDC changed its guidance on 27th of July, advising that everyone should wear face masks in schools. Ron DeSantis issued his executive order banning mask requirements on 30th of July, calling the CDC's rule unscientific and inconsistent. Several of the parents who filed the lawsuit have children with pre-existing conditions such as asthma that make them especially vulnerable to COVID-19. Some 23,903 new infections were recorded in the Sunshine State on Friday, 6th of August, the third record-breaking day in a week. On Saturday, 7th of August, Florida recorded 13,747 hospitalizations related to COVID-19, with at least 2,753 patients in intensive care units statewide, accounting for 43% of the intensive care unit beds available. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis branded media scrutiny as fear-mongering and said, "Our hospitals are open for business. We're not shutting down. We're going to have schools open. We're protecting every Floridan's job in the state. We are protecting people's small businesses." Elsewhere, the U.S. city of Austin, Texas, home to 2.4 million people, has just 6 available hospital beds in its intensive care wards. Officials in the Lone Star State described the situation as dire, while Texas Governor Greg Abbott was accused of having deaths on his hand for preventing counties, cities, public health authorities, and local government bodies from requiring people to wear face masks or be vaccinated. In a dramatic illustration of the crisis, an 11-month-old girl with COVID-19 had to be airlifted more than 150 miles from Houston to Temple for treatment this week because all 5 pediatric hospitals in the state's largest city were full. The United States is suffering a significant spike in cases with the arrival of the Delta variant of the coronavirus. On 22nd of June, there were just 11,299 new cases, but this weekend, that figure soared to 107,143. Hospital admissions are up 40% from the previous week, while the 7-day average for daily new deaths also increased over the past 2 weeks from about 270 deaths per day to nearly 500 deaths per day on Friday. U.S. President Joe Biden has declared the latest wave as the pandemic of the unvaccinated, with half the population still not double-jabbed despite vaccine availability across the nation. More than 97% of people hospitalized with the virus have not been vaccinated, according to Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the U.S. Center for Disease Control, the CDC. About half of all new infections and hospitalizations in the past week were in 7 southern states: Florida, Texas, Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi. Even though they represent less than a quarter of the country's population, said White House coronavirus coordinator Jeff Zients. In Alabama, firebrand Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene, was cheered at a political fundraiser when she suggested that people take up arms against volunteers promoting coronavirus vaccines through door-to-door outreach. The state has the lowest vaccination rate in the country, with only a third of its 5 million residents fully vaccinated. Some 65,000 vaccine shots have been thrown away by health authorities in the state because they expired. In America, more than 616,000 people have so far died from the coronavirus.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. In the previous episode, we said we will talk about the mission statement of Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salamullah when he rose up against Yazid, standing up for human rights and for humanity. Before I say what the Imam said, every great personality in history, when you look at their life, you will see that they have a slogan themselves that they live by, a phrase either of their own creation or something they took from other personalities that preceded them, a statement that they look up to and becomes the core of their life, something they would revolve around, something that gives them encouragement, something that empowers them to do that which is right. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he also gave a statement. So as the Imam salamullah alayhi was about to leave the city of Medina, which is his home place, towards Karbala, many people were wondering, why would the Imam do such a thing? Considering the fact that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, when Yazid became the ruler, he sent a message to his governor of Medina. He said, you need to take allegiance from Al-Hussein ibn Ali, which Imam Hussein salamullah alayhi says, someone like me, mithli la yubayu'u mithla. Someone like me will never give allegiance to someone like him. Why? Because I am a person who stand up for human rights. I'm a person who stand up for humanity. And Yazid is a corrupted person. And the Imam salamullah alayhi, he mentioned a few things that Yazid was doing, that he drinks alcohol and he plays with monkeys. He said, such a person, how could I give up my allegiance to him? So the Imam made the decision to leave Medina and to rise up. When people were wondering, even from amongst his family, were saying, why would you leave? Well, why don't you just give bay'ah, give allegiance and call today? You know, we don't need this hassle, we don't need these problems, you know, between Bani Hashim and Bani Umayyah. You know, let them do whatever they want. The Imam salamullah alayhi, he says, no. He says, I have to leave. And when he left Medina towards Mecca, from Mecca to Karbala, he left this statement for us to ponder and contemplate on. He says, إِنِّي لَمْ أَخْرُجُ أَشْرًا وَلَا بَطِرًا. I did not leave out of vain or for fun. Because obviously, you know, he's trying to make a clear statement that many people, when they leave their cities, they either they go to have fun or they, you know, out of vain, they just have nothing else to do. The Imam says, keep in mind that I'm neither going to have fun nor am I just, you know, I have extra time on my hand. But he says, actually, he continues, he says, وَلَا مُفْسِدًا وَلَا ظَالِمًا. Nor am I an oppressor, nor a corrupted person. Because sometimes people go from one city to another to cause corruption and oppression. He says, I am neither of these four things. Not for fun, not out of vain, not for corruption or oppression. And then we say, oh Imam, why did you leave then? What was the purpose of your trip? He says, إِنَّمَا خَرَجْتُ لِطَلَبِ الْإِصْلَاحِ فِي أُمَّةِ جَدِّي رَسُولِ اللَّهِ. I only went to seek and create reform in the nation of my grandfather. When he says he is going to create reform, it indicates that the ummah of his grandfather or the nation of his grandfather is obviously corrupted, because if it wasn't, it wouldn't need reform, would it? And reform on what level, we ask? What kind of reform was the Imam salamullah alayhi trying to rectify or trying to fix? Is it wealth? Is it something else? What kind of reform was Imam Hussein alayhi salam was trying to seek? Before we say what kind of reform, let us take a short break and we will come back inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are still listening to the program For Humanity. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, when he said, I am going out to seek reform, in the sense that the lives of people, the livelihood of people was in a miserable condition. Because people were looked at by the ruling government as nothing but servants, as nothing but peasants, someone who has no value. That's one. Two, they weren't given their rights. For example, the Muslims back then, they used to have the treasury, which what they called Baytul Mal. We have the same system in many countries these days. They call it social welfare or social security or what have you, where they pay the citizens of that state or of that country or that nation. So Yazid used to take everything to himself, and he never used to give anything to people. So the Imam Salamullah Alayhi, when he saw that people being enslaved, their rights were taken, they don't even have the right to express themselves, because if they do, they would get killed, and so on and so forth. So in every level of society or of the lives of people was being corrupted. So the Imam says, I am going to seek reform in this nation of my grandfather. أَأْمُرُ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ فَأَنْهِي عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. Obviously, I am trying to enjoin good and forbid evil, because, and this is a duty not only for the Imam alayhi salam, but this is a duty for all of us, that when we see corruption, we need to do our job when it comes to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. And then he says, وَأَسِيرُ بِسِيرَةِ جَدِّي صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَآلَهِ وَأَبِي عَلِيُّ بْنِ أَبِي طَالِبٍ. I want to use, or I want to adopt the same method of that my grandfather and my father Amir al-Mu'mineen, because the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi and Amir al-Mu'mineen were the most righteous human beings ever walked the earth, and they dealt with people in such a beautiful manner and a just manner that the Imam alayhi salam says, I will use their method as well. I will use their tradition, their sunnah, in the same way that they lived with people. From here, the Imam Salamullah Alayhi, making such a statement, we understand why he left in the first place, why he had to rise against Yazid and those who were following Yazid. Because there was corruption. The Ummah, the nation, was corrupted. And was corrupted not because the people were corrupted, rather the government itself was corrupted. If the government is corrupted, then you could assume naturally that human rights will go out of the door. So the Imam alayhi salam made that statement, and he went to Karbala under that banner of what? Seeking reform. Me and you, we have to make that mission, or that statement, mission of Imam Hussein, our statement in life, that we need to always and constantly seek reform, at least in our houses or in our environment or in our community or in our society. That's a duty that me and you need to do, not an option or recommendation or it depends on your mood. No, no, no. If you see corruption and you claim to be a fellow of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, you have to walk his path as well. You have to do what he did. It doesn't matter the cost, because as we all know, the Imam Hussein alayhi salam gave the ultimate price for such a mission. Inshallah, we will continue this in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Florida's COVID-19 surge is so out of control that if the state were a nation, the U.S. would have to consider banning travel from its residents, warned an infectious disease expert. Governor Ron DeSantis has painted himself into a corner, said Dr. Jonathan Rayner, adding, people are dying in Florida. It's going to get much worse. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Mary Papenfest, journalist. This article is published under the heading, If Florida Were a Nation, U.S. Would Consider a COVID Travel Ban, documents show. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. We'll be right back. Florida's COVID-19 surge is so out of control that if the state were a nation, the U.S. would have to consider banning travel from its residents, warned an infectious disease expert. Infection levels in Florida have risen 51% in the last 7 days, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. The state reported 134,506 new COVID-19 cases from July 30 to August 5th, more than any other 7-day period. The viral load in Florida is so high right now, there are really only two places on the planet where it's higher: Louisiana and Botswana. Dr. Jonathan Rayner, a professor at the George Washington School of Medicine and Health Sciences, said on CNN recently, "It's so high in Florida that I think if Florida were another country, we would have to consider banning travel from Florida to the United States," he said. And despite the soaring risk, GOP Governor Ron DeSantis is taking no precautions. In fact, DeSantis signed an executive order banning vaccination and mask mandates, including in public schools. He said he wants to allow freedom of choice for parents and likes seeing the unmasked faces of smiling children. Some of those parents sued DeSantis recently, arguing that weak health regulations in Florida schools threaten the safety and lives of their children, denying them their right to an education. The suit, filed in Florida state court, claims that DeSantis' order banning mask mandates violates a provision of the state constitution that requires public officials to ensure schools are safe for students. Rayner said that DeSantis has painted himself into a corner with his hardline opposition to safety measures. He warned, "People are dying in Florida. It's going to get much worse." In another court decision regarding DeSantis' anti-science stance on the coronavirus, a U.S. District Court judge granted a temporary injunction saying that the governor can't stop Norwegian cruise lines from requiring customers to provide proof of vaccination. Derek Schaefer, an attorney for the cruise company, said during a court hearing recently, "It's scary what's happening in Florida. All of Florida is a hot spot. All we are doing is trying to protect our staff and passengers." According to reports, on Monday, August 9th, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported 28,317 new cases in the state. Numbers from Sunday, August 8th, showed 28,316 people tested positive. The Florida Department of Health said those numbers were accumulated over multiple days and later provided the following figures. On Friday, August 6, 21,500. On Saturday, August 7, 19,567. On Sunday, August 8, 15,319. The three-day average, 18,795. It remains unclear whose numbers are accurate. In the meantime, as more people contract the coronavirus in Florida, more people are winding up in the hospital. Florida currently has 13,000.